Good news presentation, huh? We'll talk about the devil today. Don't know if we call that good news or not. Well, actually, at the end of the story is good news. You know, the 6th and the 7th chapters of Genesis, we're not going to go there today, but in those chapters, you're aware, of course, that you read about the great flood. You read about the sons of God marrying the daughters of men. We believe that to be in the line of Seth, and they intermarried with the line of Cain, it wasn't a matter of interracial marriage, as some people have suggested. It's a marriage of the good guys marrying into the families of the bad guys. And the bad guys didn't become better, the good guys became worse. I think that's what that's all about. But in chapter 7, you read about the great flood. Now, it's interesting, when you look around the world, you see traditions, flood traditions, in the various cultures. Many of them. There are whole books written on the different flood traditions. And while those different stories differ from the Genesis narrative in many ways, they also have a lot of similarities. And we have said over the years that, contrary to what some of the higher critical scholars would have us believe, that they believe that the Genesis story of the flood was borrowed from perhaps the Epic of Gilgamesh or one of the other flood traditions. But the real story there, as far as I'm concerned, is the fact that there are so many traditions. What does that tell us? A tradition, a flood tradition here, one over there. People have never seen each other, never heard of each other, didn't know each other existed. And they have a flood tradition where a small group of people were saved by way of a boat or a huge log or whatever it may have been. But there are flood traditions. That tells us there must have been an origin for that. It tells me, or at least to me, that stands as strong support for the authenticity of the Genesis narrative. Now, there are other traditions we find in the various cultures around the world. We look at some of the primitive tribes in South America, in Africa, and other places, as well as look at some of the literature preserved from ancient times, some of the epics and so on. And we find stories about gods. We know that most cultures in the world are polytheistic. Many scholars debate the question as to whether polytheism came first or monotheism. I think it's an answerable question. Monotheism came first. That's belief in one God. Polytheism, of course, is belief in multiple gods. But you do find polytheism all around the world. You wonder, well, what about that? And you find stories of the gods, different names, in many cases involved in different activities, but you have some very strong similarities in these stories. You have gods who are good and helpful, and you have gods who are bad. They require sacrifices, or they won't give you what you want. They'll cause bad weather or whatever to befall you, or cause bad luck. These ideas are out there. They have been out there for centuries in the pagan cultures, in many of the primitive tribes today. We see it. But there's another element in all those polytheistic groups all around this world. We see it everywhere. It's not universal in the sense that every polytheistic nation or group or tribe has what I'm about to describe here, but we do see it around the world. And that is that many of these polytheists, I would say most of them, not only believe in a plurality of gods, good gods as well as evil gods, but they, for the most part, believe that there is one supreme being above all the gods. And that he alone is eternal in the absolute sense. That is to say, he had no beginning. All the other gods were born, or there's some way or other they came into existence. You have all these legends about how that happened, when some kind of chaos happened somewhere and a god emerged and sprang forth. You have all kinds of ideas like that. But what is interesting is you have a tradition found in many polytheistic tribes and cultures of a supreme being. In other words, there is an element of monotheism there, as well as polytheism. Now, believe it or not, we find something like that even in the Bible. But first, let me read something from an evangelical theologian named Gregory Boyd in his book, God at War. He says this on pages 124 and 125 of his book. God at War is the name of it. He says, let me begin here, in page 124, says, among the Bambudi pygmies of Central Africa and Andaman Islanders in the Gulf of Bengal, two tribes that had not yet learned how to make fire when first discovered, there is, in the midst of their animistic polytheism, a belief in a single God who is above the rest, alone, immortal, creator, and omniscient. Such a perspective is almost universal among African tribes. I don't know if you realize that or not. You hear about the polytheism in Africa and some of these primitive tribes. But they believe in one God, one supreme God, one God in the absolute sense. As Nannion Smart argues, studies done on virtually thousands of African tribes reveal that, in quoting him, in most, if not all, there is belief in a supreme spirit ruling over or informing the lesser spirits and gods. And then he goes on to say, the author here, Gregory Boyd, goes on to say, this phenomenon is not limited to African tribes. It is found in various forms around the globe in other primordial traditions. So we have another tradition, in addition to the flood, of God, a supreme God, and a group of lesser gods. Now, as I mentioned a few moments ago, we find something of the same in the Bible, believe it or not. Let's start with Psalm chapter 86, the 86th Psalm, and in verse 8. Psalm 86, verse 8, says, among the gods there is none like you, O Lord, nor are there any works like yours. Like your works. So among the gods, there are none like you. Now, you could take that to mean any number of things. The term in the Hebrew is Elohim. That's Psalm 86 and verse 8. 86 verse 8. Among the gods, there is none like you, O Lord. So Yahweh is above the gods, whatever they may be. Now, you could say, well, among all the idols. Well, of course, there's none. No, it's hard to say that. It's hard for me to imagine that anybody was thinking that God, the Yahweh, was in some sense among the idols. He could have meant Yahweh is among things worshipped. But here he says among the gods. Let's put that together with some other texts. Look at Psalm 95. In Psalm 95, and in verse 3, for Yahweh is the great God, and the great king above all gods. Elohim. Yahweh, the great God. He is God in the absolute sense. He and he alone is God in the absolute sense. But this text is telling us, as we'll see other texts do, that there are other gods. So are we polytheists if we believe that? I suppose on one level you could say that, but bear with me as I get through this, and we'll talk about those other gods in a few moments. In Psalm 96, just across the page there, Psalm 96 and verse 4. For the Lord, that's Yahweh, is great and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods. And then 97, Psalm 97 and in verse 9. For you, Lord, that's, notice the all caps there, that's Yahweh, are most high above all the earth. You are exalted far above all gods. And then in 135, Psalm 135, to cover a few texts here. There are many just like these scattered throughout the Old Testament. Psalm 135 and verse 5. For I know that the Lord is great, and our Lord is above all gods. And we go on to read about the Lord of hosts. We read about a heavenly council in the presence of Yahweh, and so on. Now, of course, what we're talking about here, when we're talking about gods, and I'll refer you to Hebrews chapter 2 and verses 5 through 7, where one of these psalms is quoted. And in the psalm, in the Hebrew text, the word Elohim is used. Man was made a little lower than the Elohim. And it's translated, evidently the writer of Hebrews was following the Septuagint, but when he quoted that text out of the Psalms, he translated it, angels. Man is made a little lower than the angels. So the angels are Elohim. They're gods. They're gods in the sense that they're mighty ones. That's one of the meanings of the term Elohim. And you know, they're also gods in the same sense, or not in the identical same sense perhaps, but in a similar sense that they are gods, or that there are gods in some of the polytheistic tribes in this world. They believe in gods who are created beings. Gods who are lesser than the supreme being. In other words, they believe in angels. The problem is, somewhere along the way, they turned to these angels and started worshiping them. That's a problem. To acknowledge them as mighty ones, Elohim, gods, that's one thing. That, in that sense, Yahweh is God above all gods. So there are gods, there are multiple gods, but only one who is creator, and one who is eternal, and one who is God in the absolute sense. When you begin to turn to these other gods, though, and seek blessings directly from them, and apparently they are appointed over the nations to do various functions in the service of humankind, but when you start to serve them, offering sacrifices to them, and I have a theory about that. I can't prove it, but it seems to me, I've wondered about how some angels went bad. We often think about this happening in the ancient pre-Adamic times. And perhaps that's when the major rebellion took place. But I've wondered, did the angels lose their free moral agency at that time? Are they still free creatures like you and I are? I wonder. I think they are. The angels are free creatures. It seems to me that somewhere along the way, this is just theoretical, this is me thinking out loud, somewhere along the way, when people began to recognize that there were gods surrounding them and doing things for them, and they understood that probably from the time of the flood onward, they understood that there were angelic beings, or as they would call them, Elohim, gods, and they began offering sacrifices to them. You know, in the Old Testament, sacrifice and worship are synonymous terms. That's the way you offer worship to Yahweh. You offer sacrifice. You see that the patriarchs did it. You see that a sacrificial system came about in the time of Moses, and even a priesthood was appointed to take care of that so that the people could come worship Yahweh by way of sacrifices. And so I would say, it's my theory that somewhere along the way, people began sacrificing to these lesser gods. And I guess they liked it. Or somehow a relationship began to form that was contrary to what God wanted. And this could have contributed to their fall. Now, we'll see some scriptures. In fact, let's turn to some scriptures to see what is going on behind the scenes. And then a little bit later, I'm going to talk to you about what I have had a tendency to bring to these texts over the years, because I don't look at these texts, the Hebrew scriptures, through the ancient worldview, the Near Eastern worldview. I look at these things through the lenses of the Hubble telescope. And through, you know, the ideas that come our way through physics and biology and astronomy and all those wonderful sciences. These people didn't look at the text that way, and I'll get into that in a few moments. But first of all, let's go to Daniel chapter 9, see something going on here. This is, I always thought this was a very interesting account in Daniel chapter 9. And we'll begin reading in verse 20. So now while I was speaking, praying, and confessing my sins, he'd been fasting for a period of time. For about 3 weeks, he'd been seeking God because he wanted to know about the future of his people who had been in captivity for so long. So while I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of my God, yes, while I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, it says man, obviously it means one in the form of a man, had the appearance of a man, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, reached me about the time of the evening offering. And he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I have now come forth to give you skill to understand. At the beginning of your supplications, remember this was 3 weeks earlier, at the beginning of your supplication, as the command went out, and I have come to tell you, for you are greatly beloved, therefore consider the matter and understand the vision. Then he goes into what we call the 70 weeks prophecy. That's a subject for another time. But go over to chapter 10. Chapter 10, let's break into the account in verse 10. Says, suddenly, Daniel says, a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and on the palms of my hands. And he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly beloved, and understand the words that I speak to you, and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. While he was speaking this word to me, I stood trembling. Then he said to me, do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day, now get this, from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before God. Your words were heard, and I have come because of your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. What in the world is that? The prince of the kingdom of Persia. Well, was this the Persian human king? No. No, not at all. This is one of those principalities that we'll read about later in the New Testament. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. That's 3 weeks. The whole time that Daniel, from the time he started praying, this angel tells him, you were heard from the first day. You know, he was withstood by this prince of the kingdom of Persia. You know, you could get in some interesting discussions. Some people wonder, well, why hasn't God healed me? Or why hasn't God intervened and done this for me or that or the other thing? You know, and if you have friends like Job had, you have all these answers till God shows up. But all these answers, one says, well, it must be a lack of faith. Lack of faith, that's why God hasn't heard you. You haven't got what you've asked for. A lack of faith. Somebody else comes along, the old Calvinist in the Presbyterian church that Charles is talking about. The old Calvinist comes along and says, no, it's the sovereign will of God. God has predetermined all things, and everything falls within His will, and nothing that happens happens outside the parameters of His will. So it's according to the sovereign will of God that you haven't been answered. The world that God created, that He predestined, is not the world wherein you have your healing or whatever it is that you're asking for. So you've got His answers too. Lack of faith, it's the sovereign will of God, it's this, it's that, the other thing. You know, this tells us something right here, doesn't it? Daniel was heard. You can't, if he had friends that was a lack of faith, no, he was heard from day one. He went ahead and fasted 21 days anyway, but he was heard from day one. So you can't say it was a lack of faith, no. No. Can't say it was not within God's will for him to be answered. It was, because he sent an agent. He sent someone to answer Daniel. But you know why he wasn't answered for 21 days? Another such being held him up. Now that sounds almost fictional, but that's what the text tells us. That there is warring going on in the world of the gods. Just like you find in some of these pagan traditions. There are good gods and there are bad gods, and they are at war. And this is the battleground. There's an interaction between the gods, the activity of the gods, if I may use that term. I've explained what I mean. Between the gods and the humans. There's an interaction. What goes on in this world, the events in this world, are connected in some way with what's going on in that realm. I think of it as an extra-dimensional realm. Another dimension connected with this one. To put it in some of those modern terms that we derive from physics and so on. Let's go on and complete this account here. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. And behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left alone there with the kings of Persia. So he needed some help. Michael comes and helps him. I don't know how this kind of warfare goes on. I don't understand it. I can't get my mind around it. The text tells me it does, so I just simply accept that. I accept that it does. These are free agents. Some are fighting on the side of God, and some are fighting against God. He says, now I've come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days. Let's drop on down to verse 20. Then he said, do you know why I have come to you? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia. You're going back to the battle. And when I have gone forth, indeed, the prince of Greece will come. But I will tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth. No one upholds me against these except Michael, your prince. Michael is the prince of Israel. And these others are princes of these other kingdoms. You know, and I wonder about today. Is there still a prince of Persia? Is there still a prince of Persia motivating the leader of Persia, if you want to call him that, Iran? Are there princes at work behind the scenes? You wonder about that, don't you, when you see things going on in this world? You can't help but wonder if there is activity on that level taking place that are connected with the events that we see. Now, as I mentioned, Hebrews chapter 2 connects these angels. He uses the word angels when he's talking about the Elohim described in the Psalms. And there are many other texts that speak of the mighty ones or the gods. And because of this, some have asked, does the Bible really teach monotheism, as I mentioned earlier? And the answer is, I like the description of N.T. Wright. He says the Bible teaches creational monotheism. Creational monotheism. That is to say, God created. As far as creation is concerned, the one who stands above all creation and is the author of creation, the one who alone is eternal. See, the angels themselves are part of creation. But creational monotheism is belief in the one creator, God. But there are others that may be called God, even in the pagan sense. They're gods, I should say, multiple gods. Because they're created beings. Evidently, they live on. They live on. They don't just die off. So they are gods. But only one God in the absolute sense. Now, as I said earlier, we often think of angels going bad in the distant past, but I explained my theory. Now, my theory is based in part on what I see going on in the real world. Now, this is not a universal law. It doesn't always happen this way, but very often, as the leader goes, so goes the group under him. Have you ever seen that? We see it in the world, don't we? We see it in churches. As the leader goes, so goes the congregation. And sometimes, literally, so goes the congregation. There they went. Many follow the leader. Now, that's not a universal rule, but so often it does happen. And you can't help but wonder in this interplay between the spirit realm and this world, the nations and tribes of this world, whether or not you see such a thing going on. It could be that because of the influence of fallen leaders, maybe God had appointed some of these beings over nations in the past, and for whatever reason they fell, maybe due to worship offered to them, maybe for some other reason. But in any case, they were the legitimate appointees by God Himself over these various nations. And then when they went bad, then the people, it seems, began to follow their lead. They had an influence on them. Their negative influence led them further away from God. Yeah, that's a possibility. It seems reasonable to me. Now, I admit that there was a time. You know, I look in the New Testament and I see very plainly it says that Satan is the god of this world. The word theos is used. He's the god of this world. He's the prince of the power of the air. That doesn't mean he's, somebody once made the suggestion that means he's like a powerful radio broadcaster and he's broadcasting his nature off through the air and little babies or newborn babies are picking it up and so human nature is acquired satanic nature. Some of you remember when that sort of thing was taught in the past. That's not in Scripture anywhere. The prince of the power of the air, that's a reference. Paul was simply using to the Ephesians, he's talking to the Ephesians. This was something they were familiar with because it was a part of one of the rituals that occurred in their city. People would go into this trance and seek possession by the Lord of the air, as one of these demon spirits. They didn't look on as demons necessarily, but they could derive certain, I suppose, benefits, they thought, from the Lord of the air. Well, Paul is saying he's the prince of the power of the air, the devil is. He's the god of this world, the god of this age. But, you know, I admit that there was a time when I was inclined to reject the notion of Satan and demons as literal personal beings. It would be easy to go that route because I bring to the text the ideas, the worldview, the paradigms of one who was formed and shaped in the 20th century, in the latter part of the 20th century, and hopefully still being formed and shaped now in the 21st century. Makes me sound ancient, doesn't it? But I bring my experience to the text. So naturally, when I read the text, I think of modern psychology. I think of, for example, I read the text about some demon-possessed individual brought to Jesus. He falls into a trance, it seems to be describing some kind of seizure in some cases, or epilepsy, or something of that sort. And so I've often thought, or at least in the past, my thinking was that, well, maybe that's really what it was. And they were just using this idea of demon possession in the same way, just a personification of bad things, in the same way that we personify death with the Grim Reaper. How many of you believe that there's a real Grim Reaper, a personal being that comes when it's time to die, and he appears there, and he has his the thing he carries, what do you call that? Sickle, has his sickle with him. It's not a popsicle either. He has that with him. Nobody in here believes such a thing, do you? But yet we talk about, when the Grim Reaper comes. And one of my favorite coffee cups, when I go home to visit Mom, she has on the coffee cup, it has this terrible-looking figure there, the Grim Reaper there with his sickle, and it says, "Relax, I'm only here for the cake." So we talk about the Grim Reaper. That's the personification of death. We also talk about our personal demons, and we're not talking about personal beings, spirit beings. We're talking about our struggles with whatever the case may be. Some people struggle with smoking. They describe that as their personal demon. Or alcohol, that's their personal demon. Or drugs, pornography, all kinds of demons. And we understand what they mean, don't we? We hear about ghosts from the past. Nobody jumps and says, "Oh, where?" Now, you're not scared, are you? Because you know what all that means. Well, there was a time when I looked at the Scriptures, and just like the old Socinians of the Radical Reformation, and they came to the same conclusions, and you see those same conclusions in today's Christadelphians, the descendants of the Socinians, followers of Faustus Socinius back in the Radical Reformation period, who went way beyond any of the other reformers, to the point of denying the divinity of Christ, of denying a personal devil, and so on. But it seemed rational to me somehow that the devil was simply a personification of evil, a literary device, and that the demons were really just a way, kind of like the Grim Reaper or our personal demons, of describing bad things, bad health, health problems, mental health problems, and so on, epilepsy, whatever the case may be. But yet, when you look at the text carefully, at the New Testament text, look at it carefully, you have to conclude, I had to conclude, when I asked the question, what did Jesus really believe? There's no question in my mind that he really believed in the existence of a personal devil. He really believed in the existence of real and personal demons, spirit beings. He believed it. When he cast them out, he didn't perceive that he was really healing people of epilepsy or things of that nature. Not that he didn't do that as well. I'm sure he did. But he seemed to recognize it, and he certainly believed, as did the apostles, in the existence of these things, of these spirit beings, evil spirit beings. Now, when I read the Old Testament text from the point of view of one who grew up with modern science, as I said earlier, and medicine, and biology, astronomy, and physics, from the Newtonian laws to Einstein's theory of relativity, to quantum mechanics and string theory, you get into the quantum world and Newton goes out the window, whether there's a reason for it or not, because of the law, the non-law of uncertainty, whatever you want to call it. That if you get a headache from Newton, you'll get a migraine from quantum mechanics. I tell you, it's more than I can get my mind around. I don't think anybody can. It's just it's still relatively new. I mean, it's been around a while, but as far as really understanding it, it's still relatively new. But those are fascinating studies. The Big Bang. I grew up in the world where the Big Bang was talked about, where there's evidence for it. We hear about the space-time fabric. I don't think Moses heard about that one. And how that the existence of massive objects like the Earth and the Sun and so on in this space-time fabric warps the space-time fabric. And then comes Einstein's theory of relativity related to that, the space-time continuum. And I tend to bring these things to the text, but I should also try to read the text. It's okay to do that to a certain extent. I read the book of Genesis. I believe it's true. I believe God did create, and I believe that modern science sheds some light on the book of Genesis. I think modern evolutionary theory, the actually the evidence against it is supportive of what we see in the book of Genesis as far as man being a special creation and the animals being created, not evolving, all evolving from a single cell organism. But you know, we need also to read the text from the point of view of the Near Easterners who first had the text read to them, or who wrote the text. We need to read it from their point of view. And when we begin to get our minds around the concepts that were in their minds, we find things all over the place, at least possibilities all over the place, as far as the existence of a spirit world is concerned. You know, you go through the Old Testament, and the truth is, if we read it from our modern perspective, just read it as it is, I don't find much about Satan there. That's one of the things that used to trouble me. I do find some references, but the vast majority of those references have the definite article, and it simply means the adversary. Take the book of Job, for example. Someone may say, well, yeah, there you have the angels in heaven, and here Satan comes among them. So isn't that proof that they believed in Satan? I used to look at that and think, is that really what it says? All it tells me is some group of people or group of something called sons of God appeared before Yahweh. Well, don't you do that at the Feast of Tabernacles? You appear before Yahweh. That's what it says back in the text. I don't know that this wasn't just merely a group of righteous men appearing before Yahweh, before the tabernacle, to offer sacrifices. I don't know. That's my old way of reasoning. Now, there's some information that sheds light on it and tells us what they really were. And then the adversary has the definite article there. The adversary. It's not a proper name necessarily. The adversary came among them, just somebody who was there to contend for whatever reason. And just like Balaam, who had some reason seemed to have powers to cast spells and so forth on people, this adversary apparently had those kinds of powers too, or at least it was perceived that he did. So he has this conversation with God. So we're not told that much in the text. And all the other the references to Satan are things that can be explained differently from the way we normally think about it. And you look at the life of Abraham, of Isaac and Jacob. They didn't go around battling demons. It's not even in the text. It's like all of a sudden in the intertestamental period, or when the Jewish apocalyptic writings began to emerge, all this influence from Babylon and so on, and then it seems that the New Testament more or less carried on with the themes that were developed in the apocalyptic literature. You find all kinds of demons and angels and all kinds of things like that in the apocalyptic literature. They've got lists of them. They've got them named. All kinds of things. And you think, oh, wait a minute. That used to bother me. I said, did the New Testament just simply follow these old Jewish traditions? And because you look at the New Testament, you have Christ contending with the devil. You have Christ casting out demons time and time and time again. We're told that he came, his purpose in coming was to defeat the devil. We're told that he defeated principalities and powers. He's talking about demons. All those texts, and you think, well, it's troubling, you know, that it doesn't follow the Old Testament as much as it does the intertestamental, the later material, the Jewish apocalyptic. But there's a reason for that. There's a reason for why the Jewish apocalyptic material developed as it did. It's not that it's all right. There are many ideas, many theories there. But there are some basic concepts there that apparently were known to Near Eastern people all along. To the people who first, to Moses himself, to the people who first read the books attributed to Moses, would have seen things in the text that you and I probably would overlook. Now, a lot of this is theoretical, understand. But I do believe it gives us some background for forming a concept of the spirit world, good and evil in the spirit world, from the basis of the Old Testament. And so we see, and what we're going to see is Old Testament and New Testament having a consistency, and New Testament not so much dependent on Jewish apocalyptic. But go back to Genesis 1 with me. I'll read something here. Now, and I'll read this the way a Near Eastern person would read the text, the concepts that he would have in the ancient world. It says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void. The words bohu and tohu, meaning chaotic and in confusion. That right away says something to the Near Eastern mind. Chaotic, confusion, some other things here would say something to the Near Eastern person. And darkness was on the face of the deep. The deep? Wait a minute. These are all terms associated with pagan gods. Did you know that? Darkness, the deep, you know what the deep was? The deep is where the abyss is. You know what the abyss is? The dwelling place of the gods. The sea, you know what the sea is? It's the Hebrew word Yam. Yam is the name of a god. So a Near Eastern person reading this text would see right away, he would think right away, well, this is talking about God overturning the forces of darkness, the forces of evil, overturning the forces of chaos. And how did this chaos come about? Well, these little clues in the text, the deep, darkness, without form and void, etc. That's the idea. Now, the way it's presented here is God. These are presented as simply natural phenomena. The deep means the ocean, the waters, and so on. I think it's because Yahweh, God, did not want these people to think in pagan terms. And yet we're going to see a little bit later that God Himself used some of their own terms in describing His actions in the world, and suggesting that there are principalities and powers behind the scenes at work in the events of this world. And then later he goes on to say, and this is something else that would jump off the page to the Near Eastern point of view, in verse 26, God said, "Let us make man in our image according to our likeness." Let us make man in our image according to our likeness. You know what the Jewish interpretation of this verse is? Has been for a long, long time. You know, we use it, of course, to say that there's plurality within the deity. Let us make man in our after our likeness, in our image after our likeness. The Jewish interpretation of this is that no, it's God. It goes on to say that God did the creating. He's not saying others would be involved in the act of creating, but he has his heavenly counsel, and he's saying, "Let us make man in our image." He's presented over and over as, you know what the words "Lord of Hosts" means, Lord of Hosts, the heavenly hosts, his heavenly counsel. Apparently, in the book of Job, those sons of God were in fact angels. They were the hosts that surround him, his counselors, as it were. So you mean God needs counselors? He can have them if he wants them. I'll put it that way. He can involve his creatures in his activities in this world. Now, you know, this is not a doctrinal matter, but I'm just telling you how a Near Eastern person with a Near Eastern worldview would read this text. God, in the company of the gods, was saying, it's now time to create man. And then later on, you know, when man ate the forbidden fruit and they drove him out of the garden, he said, he's now become like one of us. Again, consulting with his heavenly council, the elders, the living creatures, whatever they consist of. But that's a possibility. I'm throwing that out as a possibility. I'm not saying that it's a doctrinal matter one way or the other. I think it's good to be open to possibilities when you read texts like this. So, You do find this sort of thing. Now, again, he's careful to describe these things that would be seen as the activity of the gods. Yam and his hosts in the depths of the sea as being at war with Yahweh. But Yahweh here, God here, is describing these things as natural phenomena. But the point is, even if the Near Eastern worldview sees these other concepts there, Yahweh is above them all and takes charge and causes the sea to roll back, pushes back Yam and his forces, in other words, and the dry land appears. So Yahweh is over all. He's above all the gods, no matter how powerful those gods may be perceived to be. Now, and I want you to look at Psalm 74. Psalm 74. First of all, verse 10. O God, how long will the adversary reproach? There's a reference to the adversary here. will the enemy blaspheme your name forever. Drop to verse 13. You divided the sea. You divided the Yam. By your strength, you broke the heads of the sea serpents in the waters. Sea serpents? Sometimes we read this and try to think in terms of what kind of modern or what kind of ancient creatures this was talking about. Some kind of dinosaur? I don't think so. No, this is in Near Eastern language, these are those gods. The oppositional, those who opposed Yahweh. Say, you divided Yam by your strength. You cut Yam to pieces. You broke the heads of the sea serpents in the waters. You broke the heads of Leviathan in pieces. Folks, this is not a crocodile either. You may have heard that this is a crocodile. Leviathan must be some kind of crocodile. Some said it's a dinosaur. No, Leviathan is a mythical beast, a mythical godlike creature who dwells in the sea. That's what it is. That's what Leviathan is. And God here is using this description to describe, in order to, as a symbol of or as a reference to something else that he really has taken issue with. Leviathan, in other words, the mythical beast, just like the seven-headed dragon in the book of Revelation is a symbol of Satan, Leviathan here is a symbol of a power at work in this world. You broke the heads, notice that, multiple heads, a multi-headed beast that lives in the sea. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? You see that later in Revelation. And gave him as food to the people inhabiting the wilderness. So here God overthrows Yam and Leviathan. Look at Job, book of Job. See another reference to Leviathan in Job 7. Or actually not Leviathan in this case. He refers to Leviathan, but again to Yam. Job asks the question when he's confronted by Yahweh, says, am I the sea or a sea serpent? Am I Yam or sea serpent? Using the same kind of language that the Near Eastern reader would automatically recognize. That you set a guard over me? Then in Job 38, verse 1, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? You know, Job had these buddies to tell him what was going on. And when God shows up, he kind of sets the record straight. Says, essentially, your buddies don't know what they're talking about. That's because, you know, when we talk about what God is doing and why God has done this and that in our lives, and I tell you why God hasn't answered your prayer, and then somebody else tells you why he hasn't answered your prayer, or what you can expect and so on, we don't have in view all the variables. Just like the people who probably would have advised Daniel, just as Job's friends were advising him, didn't have the variables in view. The angelic battle going on behind the scenes. They didn't know why why Daniel's answer was delayed. But continue on here in Job 38. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone? Then the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Who could that be other than the heavenly council? Or who shut in Yam, the sea, with doors, when it burst forth and issued from the womb? Again, I'm reading this as from a point of view of a person brought up in the ancient Near East. When it burst forth and issued forth from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, when I fixed my limit for it and set bars and doors, when I said, this far you may come, but no farther, and here your proud waves must stop. You see, Yam was perceived as being this raging god of the sea, and nobody could stop him when his wrath was being brought forth. You know, we could talk in terms of hurricanes and tidal waves or tsunamis and all the things like that, and possibly that was connected, the raging waves of the sea. But God is saying here that he can control all of that. He has power over all that. We can think of it in the naturalistic sense, or we can understand it in the backdrop of this, the Near Eastern thought of a sea monster, a powerful sea beast, a multi-headed beast dwelling in the sea and causing all of these troubling effects. God says, I set the boundaries for Yom. I hold Yom back. I put the bars up, stop him here. He goes no further. That's as far as he goes. In other words, he's declaring his supremacy over all the gods, however you perceive them. And of course, in the same breath, over nature itself. And there are many other such texts. We're not going to go to all of them. I would like to turn over to Isaiah chapter 51. Isaiah chapter 51, we see the name of another God here. We see, so far we've seen Yom. We have seen that now we're going to find another. Apparently this is another name for Yom that we're going to read about in this text. It's Isaiah 51, and we've seen Leviathan. So there are two gods are named. And again, apparently this is a reference to Yom, but a different name is used. In Isaiah 51, beginning in verse 9, awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in the ancient days, in the generations of old. Are you not the arm that cut Rahab apart? This is not Rahab the harlot, by the way. No, not Rahab the harlot. This is Rahab, another name apparently for Yom, a great creature of the sea, a sea monster. Are you not the arm that cut Rahab apart and wounded the serpent? Are you not the one who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, and made the depths of the sea a road for the redeemed to cross over? He's connecting here his battle with the gods with the event of the Exodus. You know, God gained victory over the gods of Egypt, as he says. He defeated the gods of Egypt. And here he seems to be making that connection. He's the one who cut down Rahab, who defied Rahab. He divided the sea, showing Rahab, who's also Yom, the god of the sea, as it were, showing Rahab that he has no power in his presence, that there's no comparison. Then while you're in Isaiah, go back to 27. By the way, the word Rahab means boisterous one or storm, simply storm. Another name for Yom, the sea. Isaiah 27. Here we find a reference to Leviathan. I'm sorry to... let's just read it and see what it refers to. Isaiah 27, and we'll start in verse 1. Oh, yes, it is Leviathan. In that day the Lord with his severe sword... great and strong, will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent. Leviathan, that twisted serpent. And he will slay the reptile that is in the sea. This is clearly a reference, not to some ancient dinosaurs. You know, some of the young earth creationists look at texts like this and they say, well, that's evidence that the dinosaurs were still around in the time of Isaiah. No, it's not. This is a mythical beast, but it's used as a symbol of something that is very real, and it's not a dinosaur. Not a dinosaur at all. So Psalm 74, verse 14, by the way, speaks of, we read earlier, speaks of Leviathan having been defeated. This is talking about the future when Leviathan shall be defeated. And we find that same concept in the New Testament, don't we? We find that Jesus Christ, in his resurrection and his ascension, defeated the principalities and the powers, making an open display of them. You know what that means? It's in the book of Colossians. You know what it means when it says making an open display of them? What it means, that he's using the terms that would have been familiar to the Romans of that time. When the Roman soldiers conquered a people, they marched them through the city, making an open display. These are the defeated. And in effect, when Christ defeated the devil and the demonic realm, he made an open display of them, figuratively speaking. In other words, it's the language of defeat. He accomplished his purpose. And we find the devil, what I was about to say, we find that he was defeated, and in the book of Revelation, he shall be defeated. So the final defeat is yet future. But he has already been, in principle, defeated. And that means if you and I are in Christ, then we don't have anything to worry about. He who is in us is greater and more powerful than the one who is in the world. Now, in Job 40, we read about Behemoth. A lot of people think that's... Go back to Job, and I'm going to read chapter 40, but we're going to see something in chapter 41 in connection with what he says in chapter 40. We read about Behemoth in chapter 40, and you read it, it does sound like some kind of animal, like an elephant or perhaps a hippopotamus, and there's been some guesswork as to what this is. I think some people have found another dinosaur here, but I don't think it's a dinosaur. And I really don't think, even though it has a description resembling a physical animal, of some sort, I think really what he's talking about here is some kind of cosmic monster like Rahab or Leviathan. Because in chapter 41, he goes on to talk about Leviathan. Verse 1, he says, "Can you draw out Leviathan?" This is God speaking now. "Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook? Or snare his tongue with a lion which you lower? Can you put a reed through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook?" Now, this would apply, even if this were a T-Rex, it would apply for sure, but that's not what he's talking about here. Leviathan is not a T-Rex. Leviathan is a mythical beast. "Will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you?" A little bit of sarcasm, it seems. Is he going to speak softly? Apply that to the devil. "Can you hook him and drag him out of wherever he is? Will he speak softly to you? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you leash him for your maidens? Will your companions make a banquet of him? Will they appropriate him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. Never do it again." He goes on. Of course, the point here he's getting to is there's no man that can deal with Leviathan. This multi-headed beast from the sea. No man can deal with him. But God is saying he can. And he alone can. So he's using Leviathan here, which was well known in that culture as one of those... cosmic monsters, if you want to call them that, a demonic creature, one of the gods, if you will. And Yahweh is saying that he and he alone has that kind of power. So Job, you and all your friends, you've got all this knowledge. Think you've got it all figured out. Well, you don't really know anything by comparison. Well, when we approach these scriptures with a Near Eastern perspective, and then we compare them with direct Old Testament references to Satan, and there are a few, such as in the book of Job, he does talk about the sons of God and the adversary coming among them. From that point of view, it's clear what he's talking about there. And we do have at least one scripture where Satan, the word Satan, is used as a proper noun. It's in the account of David numbering Israel. Satan provoked him to number Israel. It's used in that sense as a proper noun, and no doubt this is referring to one of those principalities at work behind the scenes. So when we compare all of these scriptures from a Near Eastern perspective with the direct Old Testament references to Satan and with the extra-dimensional princes that we read about earlier in Daniel's prophecies that are somehow connected with the nations and doing battle behind the scenes, then you go away with the idea that Rahab, Leviathan, and Behemoth represent real hostile powers. In the New Testament, we find the same thing. We find consistency. The multi-headed beast, empowered by the multi-headed dragon, comes out of the sea. The demonic forces, described as locusts, and those, by the way, are not German helicopters. I know that's hard for some people to accept. They're not German helicopters. They are demonic forces. They're described as locusts. They come out of the bottomless pit or the abyss. The abyss. Satan is cast into the abyss. And he's sealed in the abyss. He can't come out of it until God says he can. There comes a time when there will be no more sea. I've heard people read that text literally. Oh, there's not going to be any sea. That's not to be read literally. I'm sure that it means there will be no more place for demonic forces in the new heaven and the new earth. Now we could go through some of the messages that you might say that are behind the text in Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, many other places, and see that there's a very solid Old Testament background for what we find revealed rather clearly in the New Testament regarding the reality of a demon world, a real devil who is at work in the world and influencing people in this world and events in the world. But in closing, I'd like to just mention what this has to do with the atoning work of Jesus Christ. From the time of John Calvin, who really developed his ideas from Augustine, as did Martin Luther, the idea of penal substitution has been the predominant notion of the atonement. Penal substitution, I won't go into that today. There's no question that the New Testament does speak of the substitutionary offering of Christ. In other words, his death is in some sense substitutionary. But I'm not so sure that Calvin didn't take it a step beyond in applying, you know, and in drawing an analogy between salvation and the court of law. He was a lawyer, after all. I'm not so sure that he didn't take it beyond what the New Testament intends in that regard. But one thing that seems to be left out of the whole atonement issue, I'm not talking about the Day of Atonement. I'm talking about the atoning work of Christ, which, of course, is displayed in the Day of Atonement. But one thing that seems to be left out, and that are those many texts that tell us very plainly and show us by his example that he came to defeat the devil. He defeated Satan. And remember in Colossians 2, it tells us that he defeated the principalities and powers, making an open display of them, as I mentioned earlier. What does all that mean, and what does it have to do with your salvation? Well, simply this. We're told that in Adam we all die. Adam failed. God gave him dominion over all the creatures of the sea and all the creatures of the land, everything that's on this earth. He gave him dominion. And then Adam turned his dominion over to the serpent. He gave it to Satan. Christ comes as the second Adam, and he defeats the devil. He doesn't fail like the first Adam did. He defeats him. He confronts him in the wilderness. He does not submit himself to his temptations as Adam did. So the second Adam takes back dominion. And Satan is presently the god of this world, but in principle, Jesus Christ is now the prince over all, the king over all. And of course, in the future, he will be literally what is now in principle will be in place fully. But he took back dominion. Now, if you are in Christ, then you have that dominion now in principle. In fact, it's in effect to a large measure because, as I mentioned earlier, he who is in you is more powerful than him who is in the world. So being in Christ, dominion for mankind has been taken back. And when Christ returns, and when the devil and his minions are finally dealt with, then we'll see the fullness of what that dominion was all about from the very beginning.